90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, we rebroadcast a show from May of 2017, when host Teresa Wilkie spoke with Paul Pierce and Greta Wills of the KCMO Human Relations Department about housing discrimination against those with convictions and the laws that protect them. Then, in the second half, Teresa returns to talk with Jamie about what she found when she called and asked local apartment management companies what their policy is on renting to former felons, and we take your phone calls. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Teresa and her guest.
Good morning. We're lucky today to have Paul Pierce and Greta Wills from the Kansas City Human Relations Department. We're going to talk about employment, housing, and public accommodation discrimination. Kansas City, Missouri had its first Human Relations Commission in the 1940s by City Commission ordinance. Racial tension in our city was high in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King, and then the City Commission codified and created the Human Relations Commission. In 1981, remedial powers were given, and a 7-member Human Relations Board was created. Okay, Paul, it looks like you currently have a staff of 7, and the head is Philip Yelder, who has been director since 2005?
That's right. We have an intake officer, 6 investigators, 3 for housing, 3 for employment mainly. And as you said, Philip Yelder has been our director for a little over 10 years now, I guess 12 years now.
And explain the agency. Where are you located?
Well, our office is located on the 4th floor of City Hall at 414 East 12th Street. It's the building across from the Jackson County Courthouse on the south, the police station headquarters and municipal court on the east, and the park in front of the federal courthouse to the north.
And just exactly what is it that you do?
Well, mainly I investigate employment discrimination complaints. When I started with the department in 98, I started off as a housing investigator. We had a backlog of employment cases at that time, and after about 2 years on the job, I switched over and started investigating employment cases, and I've been doing that ever since.
So do you address any size employer?
Well, for an employer to be within the city's jurisdiction, there has to be at least 6 employees. The alleged discriminatory act has to have taken place within the city limits of Kansas City, and it cannot include a political subdivision or another level of government. The city doesn't have the authority by statute to investigate the county or the state or even the federal government. But as long as the employer is not another, government entity, and there's at least 6 employees, and there's a way to calculate, who's an employee, part-time, full-time, seasonal, what have you. So there are some initial questions to answer in terms of what employers that we can investigate. But it's 3 or 4 elements that we have to cover before we can say, yes, we have the authority to investigate this employer.
And what's your jurisdiction?
Our jurisdiction is the city limits of Kansas City. As long as an allegation arises within our geographic limits, the city of Kansas City has the authority to investigate. It can't be, for example, in Raymore, because that, of course, is outside Kansas City, Missouri. But any incident that occurs within the city limits of Kansas City falls within our jurisdiction.
And these incidents are allegations of discrimination against the person with the complaint because of race, sex, color, national origin,
disability, religion, age, and under the city ordinance, gender identity and sexual orientation. Those two last categories are not protected by state law or federal law, but our ordinance was amended to include both. I think the gender identity ordinance passed while I was working there, I think in 2010 maybe, either 2008 or 2010. Those categories, except for sexual orientation and gender identity, are protected under state law and federal law.
The other categories.
That's right.
And the federal law is currently picking up sex orientation and gender identity under stereotyping sex, Title VII sex.
Right.
So very generically. But that's bravo to the city of Kansas City, Missouri, that they're specific in the protection of people for their gender status and sex orientation.
Right.
So what is the timeliness of a complaint? Of course, the sooner the better. Is that true?
For our department to investigate a complaint, the alleged discriminatory act has to have taken place you have to file within 180 days of the last alleged discriminatory act. So for example, if someone felt like they were discriminated against based on disability and the incident that led to the filing, they believe, took place February 1st, that person would have until basically 6 months or October 1st, is that 6 months? August 1st, I'm sorry. To file that complaint to be under our ordinance. Now, that's different under EEOC regulations, which is 300 days or more like 10 months. But our ordinance, the alleged incident has to occur within 180 days of filing.
And so then you take a complaint. Is that what you call them, complaints?
Yes. Yes.
And you investigate it. How is that done?
Well, what we do is our intake officer, we have an intake form, and from that form, be it a paper form or online through our website, kcmo.org, our intake officer will generate a complaint form. It's signed by the person wanting to file the complaint, sent back to us for service on the employer. Once that happens, the employer would have 10 business days to either respond to the complaint or request some type of extension, which is common, happens all the time. But we'll receive the response statement, contact the person who's filed the complaint, and get a statement from them, the details which led to them filing the complaint. They are allowed to read over the response statement. They don't get a copy of it at the time because the case is still open. So they can read over and make comments or ask questions about what's included in the position statement. They can supply names and phone numbers of witnesses who they believe can verify the allegations of their complaint. And then we'll meet with the employer, employees, managers, supervisors are either listed in a response statement or come up during the course of an interview, and do the same thing with the witnesses, the employer's witnesses. The complainant's witnesses, if they have any, will gather necessary documents that will help us make a recommendation on the evidence. And when all that is done, there's a report that's written, a recommendation that's made on the evidence as to whether or not there is or is not probable cause to verify the allegations in the complaint.
So you do, Kansas City Human Relations Department does employment, public accommodation, and housing.
That's right.
Of those three, what do you receive more often?
Well, I believe we have more employment complaints right now in the office. I think second would be housing, and then third, public accommodations. Not because of importance, certainly, but that's just how things come in. We just seem to get more employment complaints in. And each one goes through pretty much the same process in terms of investigation.
Thank you for that. I would agree that jobs are important and housing is important. But the idea that a person could be refused service mm-hmm. or treated less favorably because of their race, sex, color in a place of public accommodation
right.
is a large part of your city ordinance. And so if a person felt discriminated against in their access to places of business right. and services, mm-hmm. They can file a complaint with the city of Kansas City, Missouri, if it happened in Kansas City, Missouri, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So now then, pertaining to those with criminal convictions, I understand the Ban the Box ordinance is an old ordinance in Kansas City, Missouri. When did the city first put that in place?
Well, the Ban the Box, as I remember, sort of started maybe 5 or 6 years ago. There was this movement to either remove the criminal history question from the application process or at least move it back to the pre-offer stage. And I think the first city I can remember to do that was New Haven, Connecticut, where they removed that criminal history question or moved that later in the process, as I said, because a number of individuals were being simply denied the opportunity for jobs when the question was asked on the application, have you ever been convicted of a felony? In some cases, they also included misdemeanor. And we all know that when that box is checked yes, the application goes in the trash. And you're not considered, regardless of what your qualifications are, regardless of how long ago the conviction was, in some cases, whether or not you were even convicted. Because in some places, just the arrest or a charge led to that removal from the applicant pool. And so the city took it upon itself to remove that criminal history question and put it later in the application process. Now, background checks can still be done and are done. And this was something, again, that the city did for city employees. And it's been, I've heard, quite successful in that our applicant pools grow because more people are making it through that initial application stage. Individuals who do have records, again, pre-offer, are given the opportunity to explain the nature of the conviction, as I said before, and give details as to what they've done to rehabilitate themselves since conviction, whether they got some type of certification, degrees, other work experience, and the like, that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to discuss had you just marked the box and been and eliminated from consideration. As part of our training, when we go out and speak with employers and HR professionals and the like, I always tell people that there are some factors that you should consider when you talk to people about criminal histories. First, does the conviction have a reasonable relationship to the job? I mean, if you're a bus driver or you want to be a bus driver and you've been convicted of a DUI, well, that makes sense because driving is essential to that of a bus driver. But if you've been convicted of forgery, you can still drive a bus, because and the relationship isn't the same. Secondly, the time elapsed since release from confinement. What have you done to rehabilitate yourself since you were no longer under the criminal justice system? Have you gone to school, certifications, licenses, other work experience? And I know in our research, we've shown that a person who's been released from confinement after 7 years is no more likely to reoffend than someone who's never offended before. So these blanket policies that keep people from ever getting jobs because of criminal histories don't really stand up when the evidence shows differently.
Thank you for that. That was beautifully stated. And I'm going to transition, Greta, to your housing area. I'm going to borrow from the general counsel of HUD, they passed an ordinance in November of 15, and they gave guidance on it in April 16. And housing has added this same discouragement of a blanket exclusionary policy for people with criminal convictions. And the reason for that is because across the United States, blacks and Hispanics are arrested, convicted, and incarcerated at rates disproportionate to their share of the general population. Consequently, criminal records-based barriers to housing and employment are likely to have a disproportionate impact on minority home and job seekers. While having a criminal record is not a protected characteristic under employment or fair housing, criminal history-based restrictions on housing opportunities and job opportunities violate the Act if, without justification, their burden falls more often on persons of one race or national origin over another. So, Greta, I think I first heard of you with respect to this very recent April 27, 2017 Civil Rights Summit, the seventh annual summit that Kansas City Human Relations Department did.
Right, and we have our Civil Rights Summit every year, and actually it was our ninth, and these are subjects, like Paul has mentioned, that we cover in our ordinance and other things that we investigate.
So the HUD notice came out of a United States Supreme Court case, Texas Department of Housing versus Inclusive Communities, and the Supreme Court held discrimination can be found not only when the landlord means to treat one group with prejudice, but also when the landlord has a neutral policy that harms one group of persons more than others, what we call an adverse impact of a policy. That mirrors the guidance on employment, and it addresses public housing agencies. Greta, what is a public housing agency in Kansas City, Missouri?
Well, it may become more commonly known as a housing authority, and this is an entity. It's not part of the city, but is an entity that is receives public funding or HUD funding. But the difference in the guidance that you just read is not just covers public housing issues. It also covers private industry too. I think it was initially issued to cover public housing, but they have since expanded that to include private landlords too. And just like housing, and just like employment, as Paul was describing, these blanket policies did not cover or did not give people the opportunity once they were released from incarceration or conviction, parole or probation, give them an opportunity to get housing. And it was creating what we call high recidivism, where people, like Paul was mentioning, they can't get housing, and can't get employment. It creates a cycle, and they end up back in the criminal justice system again. And I think that was the purpose of that guidance issued by HUD. Unlike EEOC, thus HUD's guidance is pretty recent, and EEOC's guidance has been in place, Paul, what do you think, for like 20, 30 years?
I was in line at the grocery store and happened to run into a friend of mine who's a landlord and said, well, I'm going to do a presentation on this HUD guidance. And he got a little excited on the idea that it should be perfectly okay to rent to people with criminal conviction history. So can we say anything to make this appear? He saw it as a problematic that, and if I rent to people with criminal history, I'm renting to people that are bad tenants. So what's your experience on that? That's not true.
No, and just like Paul had mentioned before, that that idea is not supported by statistics. There's has been research and studies done that says that a person is no more likely to commit a crime or reoffend after 7 years than a person who had not ever been convicted of a crime. So these ideas or these thoughts are not supported by evidence that you're not necessarily writing to criminals just because you use that they have criminal records. Just like Paul had mentioned also, you know, we don't expect for landlords to not do background checks or screening, but we expect for them to apply the same type of rules that Paul had mentioned. How long it has been since the conviction? Had they done anything to rehabilitate and things of that nature? And that's all that we expect for them to do, to just give people the opportunity to apply for housing. They have to otherwise still be able to pay for their housing. They still are expected to follow the rules of the landlord's tenant policy. And so all of those things still apply. This is about the opportunity to obtain housing and not be shut out just because of a previous criminal conviction. And like he said again, it does disproportionately affect minorities. Blacks and Hispanics are disproportionately affected by these blanket rules. We had one case where there was actually on the application that you could not have committed a felony within the last 100 years. Well, that was totally impractical and not grounded in senior center. So that definitely is not grounded in any kind of evidence or research or studies that have been conducted.
It's the blanket exclusionary policies that are the problem and that show the disproportionate impact on people. So it's fun to kick around this idea. If there's a blanket exclusionary policy, we don't rent to people with criminal convictions, that's going to affect both black people and white people. Mm-hmm. Unlike our regular intentional housing or employment discrimination, I'm not going to give a job to a person because of their race. I'm not going to give housing to a person because of their race. So I'm not going to give housing to anyone with a criminal conviction. That can discriminate against blacks, Hispanics, whites. Therefore, the question is that discrimination? But what we see is, given that blacks and Hispanics, minorities, are subject to conviction more frequently and stops, we've had programs on this subject before, then you have a larger number that are negatively affected by these blanket rules. And so what are some of the things you ask the landlords to consider?
Just like we had said before, we asked them to consider when it has been, how long it has been since the conviction, how if it the tenant or prospective tenant has done anything to rehabilitate. They also ask them to check if they have reoffended since the conviction. So those are the type of things that we ask them to consider.
As opposed to just having a rule saying we won't rent.
Exactly.
Right?
And when you have blanket rules like that, it will sometimes affect those protected categories. And Paul and I had a discussion earlier. It may disproportionately affect certain minorities, but the ex-offender issue itself can affect everyone, you know, because they aren't using the proper guidance, you know, they are using, you know, for screening.
That is so true. You do your time as punishment for your crime, and then in our system, you get out and continue to do your time in the real world. It's like there's no end to the time one has to do. And a person, in all fairness, can only improve, and if they have a nice place to live, if they have a house to support that. And so now then, let's talk about the evidence you guys like to see when people make complaints of either employment or housing. What type of evidence is helpful?
Employment case in employment situations, depending on the nature of the complaint, there are certain things that are relevant and some that aren't. for example, if someone feels that they're being discriminated against in terms of their attendance, obviously their attendance records and work schedules will be important, not so much a company's policy on short-term disability. So it always depends on the nature of the complaint as to what evidence is going to be required to verify or not verify the allegations in that complaint.
And the same will be for employment. If a failure to make repairs because I'm a woman, and you compare that to a male tenant, we will look at their tenant records and their maintenance records to see, okay, which tenants are you doing repairs for more often than the other. And we'll look at tenant lists, we'll look at maintenance records, and again, it just all depends on the nature of the complaint.
So I would say we all have very good jobs. Now then, this ordinances are under review in the Missouri legislature right now, the Missouri Senate Bill 43, now with the governor. That is going to create a more difficult causation standard for these cases, changing from what's currently allowed discrimination a contributing factor to it being required to be the motivating factor for a lawsuit. Individual liability for supervisors will be gone in Missouri, and punitive damages will be capped. It's very important for people to know if they want to make a complaint to bring your evidence, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Now, the calendar for March 5th. You can join the KC Metro Immigration Alliance and the Heartland Alliance for Progress today, March 5th, the deadline set by President Trump for Congress to have passed new DACA legislation. They will rally at the Jackson County Courthouse, 415 East 12th Street, KCMO, at 4:30, and then march three blocks north to the Federal Courthouse at 400 East 9th Street, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, March 5th, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force's mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or by email at redrobb, that's REDROB 2655 at yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, March 6th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. The Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, March 10th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MIST has members that may be able to help. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is Teresa, Jamie, and your calls.
Good Monday morning, everyone. Welcome to Jaws of Justice. Thank you if you're continuing to listen. We're talking about discrimination in employment and housing. Jamie Jackson, one of our volunteers, she's done a tremendous job of doing some research on the blanket exclusion to renting to felons. Jamie, good morning. And we have Keith Brownell. We're going to talk about it. And we invite anyone and everyone to call us if you have something to add. Our number, 816-931-5534. Jamie, what did you learn when you were looking at how refusing to rent to felons?
Yes, well, good morning, everyone. I first became interested in this recently because I took a job as an apartment manager, actually as a leasing consultant for a property in Overland Park last fall. And I quickly became aware that they had what I considered a disturbing policy of automatically excluding anyone who had been convicted of a felony from applying for an apartment at the property. And this particular company has, I think it's around a dozen properties in Kansas City and Overland Park, and maybe even Leawood. And they all have the same policy. They automatically exclude anyone with a prior conviction from applying for an apartment. So I got to thinking about this. I thought, well, what does this policy mean? It means that if you have a conviction, no matter how long ago it was or whatever the offense, that you are not allowed to apply for an apartment. And I, you know, if we think about it, a person could have a conviction for DUI, say, and I know people who have convictions for DUI who don't even drink now, or a conviction for shoplifting, and they have since then completely reformed themselves. Or, you know, maybe a woman has in the past turned to prostitution for whatever reason, and now she's on a good path. So those people would automatically be excluded from applying for an apartment at this property. So it turns out, and I started looking into it, that this policy is being challenged in court as discriminatory. Now, the way I understand it, it's considered discriminatory because it has an impact on minorities in greater offense than for whites. So that means that under the fair housing rules, that discrimination in housing against minorities is prohibited. The Equal Rights Center, which is an organization in Washington, D.C., filed a lawsuit saying that it was unlawful, was a violation of the Fair Housing Act of 1968, to exclude automatically, put an automatic ban on applications of people who have been convicted and recently released from incarceration. So that lawsuit is working its way through the court, and we'll see what happens. Apparently, even if they prevail, it's not going to necessarily be an automatic change to the law. But I wanted our listeners to be aware of this problem. We have to think about, well, you know, if a mother wants to take in her daughter after she's released from prison, she can't do it under this policy if the mother lives in an apartment that excludes felons. Or, you know, a wife wants to take in her husband who's trying to get back on his feet after being incarcerated. So I want to emphasize that it's not only about the law. This is about public policy and what is good for the public. We don't want to make it so hard for convicted felons to get back on their feet once they are released from prison, such that they think their only recourse is to go back to prison because they can't find a roof over their head. So,
thank you, Jamie. I'm going to take a second here and remind our listeners that as many as 100 million United States adults, or nearly one-third of our total U.S. population, have a criminal record of some sort. So what we're talking about is all of us, but what we have seen is that there are a disproportionate number of minorities incarcerated and with a history of incarceration in this country.
Yeah.
Therefore, refusing to rent to people with felony convictions has an adverse impact on minority persons looking to rent. And so it is a general public policy problem and a racial problem. Thank you.
So I called a few properties here in town. I called the properties that are managed by the same company that is being sued in Washington, D.C., and there was one in Overland Park and a couple on the Kansas City, Missouri side. So when I called them and asked them about whether they would accept an application from someone with a conviction, the person on the Kansas City, Missouri side said, yes, they would. It would not be an automatic exclusion, and he made some reference to the fair housing policies. But when I called the place in Leawood that is under this same property management company, they said, no, they do not accept applications from people who have recent convictions. And just to kind of follow up on that, I called the leasing consultant at an apartment that is operated by the same company that I worked for, and he said no, they do not accept. He is in Kansas City, Missouri. I thought maybe it was a difference in one side or the other, a state line, but he's in Kansas City, Missouri, and he said no, they don't accept. So I want to make clear also that the Equal Rights Center in Washington, D.C., they are not about trying to just do a gotcha with the property management companies. It's not about punishing property management companies. It's about steering them toward a better policy, and they actually have a online course, which is free, that they offer to property management people, which steps them through in a 7-part modules, steps them through what constitutes fair housing.
So we would like to take your calls if you have any experience with being refused housing because of criminal conviction, and you can dial 816-931-5534. I wanted to say that you have done a great job, Jamie, in doing some investigation on this blanket exclusion to persons with felony convictions, which we see has an adverse impact on the ability of minority persons in our community to get places to rent. And so if anyone feels that they have been denied housing because of their race, you can call HUD. They have an 800 number, 800-669-9777. That's the Housing and Urban Development Department of the United States government. Earlier this hour, we heard from Kansas City Human Relations Department. There is a state agency in Missouri, the Missouri Commission on Human Rights. They do housing discrimination. Their website, labor.mo.gov. And then, of course, there is a housing authority in Kansas, the Kansas Commission on Human Rights. You can get them at kchr.net, and their number 785-296-3206.
And I would like to just add one more telephone number. If you think that you have experienced discrimination related to a housing provider's criminal records screening policy. So in other words, if you have been denied the opportunity to apply for housing because of a prior conviction, then the Equal Rights Center is asking that you call them. And that telephone number is 202-234-3062. And if you're interested, you can also go to their website. It's the Equal Rights Center. And it's at equalrightscenter.org.
So, Keith, what did you want to share with us on this subject?
Well, I'd just like to state that I was released from prison 10 years ago this month, and I was homeless for about 9 months after my release because of these discriminatory practices of denying people tenancy because they have criminal records, you know. And I just want people to understand that that's one of the most essential things a person really needs when they are released from prison is to have a roof over their head. The second most essential thing is to have a stable employment if you want these people not to return to prison. I haven't been involved with any type of criminal activity since I've been released, but if I was to become homeless, I may be put in a situation where I would have to resort to some type of criminal behavior, you know, to try to, and I told the housing authority that when I gave them my application to have a tenancy at the location where I was living at. Well, they gave me the runaround. Fortunately, I was already living in that facility at the time I got a hearing. And what they didn't know is that my landlord had already pushed the application already through. And I simply told him, I said, well, I'm not here to plead the case for myself. I said, because I'm already living in the very facility that you're trying to deny me access to. I said, but I'm here to try to plead the case of other people who are in similar situations and haven't yet found a place to live. As you ride through the city here in Kansas City, and I imagine it's like that elsewhere, you see all kind of abandoned houses and vacant buildings that have caught fire by some means. A lot of times that's the result of people being homeless and living out on the street in the wintertime, and they go in these places and they start fires to try to stay warm during the winter, and the building catches on fire. You know, I don't see how people would feel that allowing anybody to be homeless is making your community much safer. You know, when you have these type of situations going on, when the fire could start, it could possibly catch fire to the next house and you know, probably kill children and things of this nature here. But you know, people have to have a place to stay, no matter where they are, no matter what color they are. You know, they need a roof over their head. This is something that's essential to everybody's well-being. And if you deny people of these things, then something's going to go wrong.
I see housing as a great stabilizer. It gives a person a platform from which to go out, work a job, do good works. And the whole idea of the problem with blanket exclusionary policies to renting to people with felony convictions is once you have a conviction, then for the rest of your life, you would have a difficult time getting renting, even when you are no longer committing any crimes. Even if you committed the crime in your youth, and I'll just go ahead and confess to our listeners, I've done some dumb stuff in my youth, and I'm sure most of us listening have. So thank goodness I get the chance to live that down, but a person with a felony conviction cannot, because they are continued for the rest of their life to be plagued with these rules that say we won't employ persons who ever had a felony conviction. We won't rent to persons who ever had a felony conviction. So it needs to be proportionate to the time that the employment or the rental agreement is being made. And you need to consider what the person who's got this on their record has done to live a life that makes you think this person could be a good tenant. They're going to work a job and pay the rent. And that's a good thing to do for each other here.
And we also had to stop and think about, we live in a society at this point that's trying to criminalize almost everything. It's so easy to become, have this jacket placed on you of being a convicted felon or criminal, you know. And I mean, I don't understand what if we can't give people a place to stay once they've been released and they've gone for years without even so much as committing another crime, may have not even committed a crime, because you have a substantial number of people who are in prison for crimes they didn't even commit. You know, once you've been arrested, it's not about whether you actually committed a crime or not. It's about the prosecutor trying to get a conviction. And they will use every means and every tactic to put pressure on you to try to make you plead guilty so they can get another feather in their cap. You know, people's lives are being destroyed. It's important that society has to understand that, and they have to come away from this concept that every time you see a person with a conviction that, you know, he's going to go out and get a gun and do something crazy, murder you, rape you, kill you, rob you, or something of that nature, because it's just not true.
I like to think about persons that commit crimes, and certainly it is a crime in this country to refuse to rent to people because of their race, sex, color, national origin, religion, age. Is affected by employment, age in housing is not, or disability. Now then, here's our number, 888-931-5534. And we encourage everyone to call us, 816-931-5534. We'd like to have some discussion on this. On the subject of breaking the laws, it's unlawful to discriminate against people in housing because of their race. And so that means some landlords are lawbreakers. And then what they're doing is they're condemning persons because they're lawbreakers. So there's a logical disconnect to this story. If you feel you have been denied housing because of your race, as Jamie did, you can do a little legwork before you call HUD. The best evidence would be if you had an idea in a rental unit that there is a white person with a felony conviction who's allowed to rent at a place that tells the black applicant for rent that they can't rent because they have a felony conviction. That's very good evidence of race discrimination. That's treating the white person with a felony conviction more favorably than the black person. Or if any landlord would say to you, we don't want to rent to you because of your race or your color or the race or color of your family members, then you need to call HUD or Kansas City Human Relations Department. And so don't be afraid to file a complaint. And we're going to begin to make this where one day people can rent and have jobs on the merits of the individual. And everyone's going to understand the importance of that.
And I just want to add a little bit to what Keith said a few minutes ago, because it's my understanding that under a new Missouri state law that considers the infliction of emotional distress a felony, it says that a person who bullies a student could face criminal charges under this new law. So now a young person could engage in cyberbullying, perhaps come to regret it, but could be saddled with a felony conviction on his record forever.
So we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air. Would you give us your name and tell us where you're calling from?
Hey, good morning. This is Jack in Shawnee.
Thanks for calling.
Good morning. What are the penalties for people who discriminate in housing or employment? I hope the laws have bite and it can really make them, you know, pay a price. Can you tell me what the penalties are if someone discriminates? Thanks.
I can well tell you the penalties in employment. So the civil rights statute in 64 was written as a full relief statute. If you were denied a job, you get the job, you get any lost pay. And then in 81, Congress amended the Civil Rights Act and allowed for damages. So I believe that that is true in housing and in employment, that you can ask for damages in addition to your lost rent, any out-of-pocket expense for the inconvenience of being denied rent.
I want to also take a little time to point out that the availability of being able to rent an apartment, it also has to do with what the nature of your crime may be. If they deny your application based on a crime that you've committed, say for instance that you want to move in a senior citizen's apartment and you have a crime on your or an offense on your criminal record for elder abuse, that's justification for them to deny you entry into that apartment. You know, if you know, we have it's a very serious problem with trying to find places to place people who have sex offenses in these. And so you can't just run out every time somebody says, well, they denied your application because you have a criminal record. You have to look at the circumstances of what the denial was based upon. And, you know, we wrestle every day with this problem about the sex offenders because nobody wants sex offenders to live anywhere. They don't want you to live in their neighborhood. They don't want you to live in their apartment buildings. They act like they don't even want you on the same planet. But, you know, we have to find a way to address these issues.
We have to learn to work together as a community and to allow the fact that people have mistakes and people have problems, and some people can come out of that and do a better job with their lives, and also to be aware of who our neighbors are. It's really not fair in a city the size of Kansas City to be living in a place and not know who your next door neighbor is. So
I also can recall, like, during the time when I was homeless and I was looking for a residency, they've got 1,000 other excuses they can give you. They don't have to tell you it's your criminal record when all the time it may be very well be your criminal record, but they've got 1,000 other excuses. You know, and in my search to find a place to live, a lot of times I would run into those situations. Oh, they tell you, we don't have any problem with you having a criminal record. It's been quite some time since you committed this offense, and we're not giving that any consideration. But, you know, they gave me other excuses, you know. So, you know, it's just something that if you're going to fight these type of situations, you have to be aware of all the things that can be used to undermine your struggle.
I think we've had a great program today. Jamie, I want to thank you for all your good work on this subject.
All right, thank you.
Did you have anything you wanted to add to what we were discussing? I want to thank the person who called in, and I want to encourage everyone to be aware that there are laws that protect you from discrimination in housing and employment. And we've given you the numbers several times. It is in your best interest to try to have some evidence. So, for example, look at the race of the tenants. Listen for evidence that they are refusing to rent to you in any way because of your race. And so I thank everyone for listening to us this morning.
It's the 420 Drug War News, and this is U.S. Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who's running for Ted Cruz's Senate seat. Recorded earlier this week out on the campaign trail, this is U.S. Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
So we just read a note from a parent who went to a PTA meeting this week. And at the PTA meeting, of course, everyone was talking about the shooting that had just happened in Florida. And the parents at that PTA meeting were instructed on how to teach their children to respond to an active shooter who comes into their classroom with an AR-15. And this is what your child is supposed to do. They're supposed to act crazy. Now, this is the new guidance. Throw books, start screaming, run around that classroom. And the mom says, well, how is that going to save my kid's life that this person has an AR-15 and can very quickly kill every child in that classroom? And what they say is that it takes it from 10 seconds to kill every child in that classroom to 20 seconds when the kids are moving around. And in those extra 10 seconds, maybe some kids can get out the door. That is what we're talking about right now, is can we save some kids at the margin? So here's something I've done. And listen, this is as you know, politically charged as it comes in Texas. And this is how I hope you know that I have the courage and my convictions, because I'm willing to do this. I co-sponsored the assault weapons ban. And now I understand there are many Texans who own these AR-15s, and some of them are very good friends of mine that I've been out shooting with. And they say, Beto, why are you going to prevent me from buying a gun? I haven't hurt anybody. I haven't shot anybody. I keep this gun in a gun locker. I teach my kids gun safety. How could you do this? Because there's some crazy evil person in Florida or Sutherland Springs or Las Vegas, or pick the next city that's going to happen. And I say, you know what? You're right. we have the Second Amendment, and it's incredibly important. But the Second Amendment is not unlimited. You cannot carry a bazooka down the street. You cannot drive your tank down the street because we have the Second Amendment. There's going to have to be some rational limit to our ability that keeps more people in our communities safe and alive. And will I get the stuffing knocked out of me by the NRA for this? Just watch it come down on us in this campaign. But I've got to look myself in the mirror. And I'm not going to answer those moms who come to my town halls and say, what are you going to do? And I say, well, you know, we got to listen and understand, or we can't control this, or there's just evil in the world, or our thoughts and our prayers are with the parents. We got to do something. And if it means, you know, we're not as viable in the election, you know, so be it. What you want is my honest opinion on this stuff. You want to know that I have the courage of my convictions? I do, and I'm glad that you're with me on this one.
Beto O'Rourke is challenging Ted Cruz for his Texas Senate seat. The word thus far is that the turnout is up 102% for Democrats in Texas. Indications are that Congressman O'Rourke will be joining us here on the Cultural Baggage Show soon. This is Dean at DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.